The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. A cabinet battle over health funding spills out onto the front pages as Boris Johnson strays beyond his brief and tries to strong-arm the Chancellor into putting billions more into the NHS. Is the Foreign Secretary on manoeuvres again? Meanwhile, Tory thinkers are starting to look beyond the day-to-day of crisis management to a new vision for centre-right politics. We'll hear from George Freeman, chair of the Conservative Policy Forum, and our expert panel. Plus, the rise of China presents a huge opportunity for Europe that will dominate the 21st century. So argues Bruno Massaich, who's here to discuss his new book, The Dawn of Eurasia. But first, slapped down by the Prime Minister, duffed up by the Chancellor, and given both barrels by the Home Secretary, Boris Johnson's pre-leaked intervention into the NHS funding debate at Cabinet did not go down well with his colleagues. But amplified by Jeremy Corbyn at PMQs, it's helped buff up his populist credentials. I'm joined in our Westminster office by Anoushka Astana. And Anoushka, in some ways, this kicked off with an interview Boris Johnson did with us, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. We were talking to him, I think, about girls' education around the world, Heather, when, as you'll remember, he pulled out a piece of paper to, what I would say, try and troll our readers.
Indeed,
by
yeah.
basically claiming the 350 million, the infamous 350 million, was actually wrong. It was an underestimate. There was going to be even more money, and of that money, he wanted to demand that it would be going to the NHS. And that kind of started off a series of articles where Boris's allies were talking to journalists about the idea that he was going to make this big demand at that cabinet meeting a week later. And as you say, it caused a certain amount of irritation among his colleagues.
But it's incredibly clever politics in some ways, isn't it? Because actually, you know, the pieces that were written in the aftermath of that cabinet meeting, although they said, you know, sort of slap down for Boris, you know, PM, you know, criticises Boris Johnson. Actually, at the end of the day, he ends up looking as if he's demanding more money for the NHS, which is quite a popular position with the public, you'd think. And Theresa May looks as if she's the woman saying no.
Well, I mean, to some extent, what he would argue is that that pre-briefing managed to put the issue at the top of the agenda. In order to try and spike his guns, Theresa May actually opened up the discussion by talking, I don't think she uses the word, but basically talking about a so-called Brexit dividend and the idea that that could be then spent on our own priorities. I think she talks about housing, schools and the NHS, notably putting the NHS last. But still, you know, it was a subject of discussion and one that a number of cabinet ministers did agree with. So to that extent, yeah, Boris can say I've had a win. But one of the things a lot of his colleagues complained about as they went round the table and, as you say, had a go at him for not keeping the discussion private. I heard that Amber Rudd actually said at one point, I'm talking to you, Foreign Secretary. But what was interesting is they were very frustrated by the way he had pre-briefed this, because they said it's basically handing over political advantage to our opponents. And as you say, Jeremy Corbyn was able to use that very effectively at PMQs the next day, essentially saying to the Prime Minister, do you agree with your Foreign Secretary over the NHS? And when she couldn't quite agree, I think that made her look quite weak.
And it is a tough political issue for them at the moment, isn't it? I mean, Labour have been hammering them about it repeatedly, and they've been incredibly kind of emotive reporting about ambulances waiting outside hospitals and people on corridors and, you know, on trolleys in corridors. It's a tough one for the Tories at the moment, isn't it?
Very, very difficult. I mean, Theresa May can say we put £6 billion in at the budget, but, you know, when the NHS itself is saying that the amount fell well short and we need to start talking about rationing, that's a difficult position for them. And, you know, we've got to look at why it is that Boris Johnson is hamming this up so much. My understanding is he's very frustrated that Theresa May's chief of staff, Gavin Barwell, has told colleagues, we can't win on the NHS, so there's no point trying. Now, he thinks you've got to try because it's too important an issue. And if we look back to 2015, when David Cameron was taking the Tories into an election, they then also thought that they couldn't win on the NHS, but they did feel they had to neutralise it. And because of that, it became a very, very big issue. Theresa May now has to do a similar thing. The problem is, in order to do that, there simply has to be more money, because otherwise NHS England will simply say, you're not doing what we've asked.
And by having this kind of discussion about where it should be on the agenda and whether you tackle the NHS now or not or when, Boris Johnson has sort of sparked off a fresh round, hasn't he, of speculation about Theresa May's leadership and how secure that might be. I mean, all of this, these manoeuvres of his in the past week or so look as if they, at the very least, they might be laying the groundwork for a potential future bid, don't they? If the ball comes loose from the scrum, as I think he puts it himself.
I think the Prime Minister must be getting very, very irritated. Every time she wants to make a big statement, he seems to try and spike her guns. So, for example, at the Anglo-France summit last week, you know, she wanted to be there talking about the relationship with France and her relationship with Emmanuel Macron, and there goes Boris mentioning the idea that many people think is mad of a bridge from Dover to Calais. And guess who's dominating the headlines for the next few days? Same again with the cabinet. Very, very frustrating. And now a suggestion that actually all of those rebels who really don't like Theresa May, and that predates all this Boris stuff, they're starting to get a bit more confident again. And perhaps a few of them are even writing letters to Graham Brady, the leader of the 1922 backbench committee, who, when he gets 48 letters, will have to trigger a leadership contest. Now, he's not there yet, but reports today suggesting that he was looking ashen-faced when he tried to persuade MPs not to write any more.
Yeah, it does feel as if it's a little bit febrile again, doesn't it? And presumably those backbenchers are writing those letters are worried about the damage to the Tory brand, are they? That's being done by this feeling that the government's sort of failing to get to grips with the sort of meat and drink domestic issues like the NHS, like social care and so on, because Brexit is such a huge distraction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they're very frustrated about it. The question is, up until now, they've been persuaded to stay fairly quiet about it. When Grant Shapps came out as one of the kind of cheerleaders of trying to get rid of Theresa May, he was pretty much silenced by the whole party. But now we're getting a drip-drip effect where people seem to feel more emboldened about speaking out.
Now, of course, the other story that's dominated this week is the all-male charity event at the Dorchester Hotel. An FT undercover reporter found young women were employed as hostesses and they were groped and propositioned by some of the richest men in the country. And Tory Minister Nadeem Zahawi was among those, wasn't he, Anoushka, with some explaining to do?
I just think absolutely astonishing revelations from the FT. I mean, some people trying to kind of, you know, make light of this. There's nothing to make light of here. You know, Jess Phillips, Labour MP, was telling me today that she's speaking to the CPS about it because she thinks that, you know, there could be charges that you could bring against some of the individuals here. The behaviour, absolutely disgusting. It's already forced, you know, a director of the Department for Education to have to stand down. And yeah, very embarrassing for the Prime Minister that Nadeem Zahawi, her children's minister, was actually there. Now, she's just responded to that, said that he felt very uncomfortable by it and that he felt that he needed to leave early. But, you know, he's been there before, he was there again, and it certainly does not look good for the Prime Minister.
Do you think it might not be over for him?
Well, I think that there will be quite a lot of pressure coming from other parties, particularly about, you know, how long was he really there? What did he know about it in advance? Did he raise his concerns in the aftermath?
We were told last night by Downing Street that he was given a dressing down. I think the phrase was reminded of his responsibilities by the Tory chief whip. We'll see whether that's as far as it goes. And meanwhile, Theresa May, after PMQs yesterday, got on a plane and went off to Davos for the World Economic Forum, which, you know, given that she's not very in favour of citizens of nowhere, seems rather odd, because I think there are more citizens of nowhere in the mountains of Davos talking about the future of the global economy than just about anywhere else in the world. But she's giving a big speech today, isn't she?
Yeah, that's right. If she's worried about the citizens of nowhere, maybe she can, you know, shack up with John McDonnell, who's also out there, and they can do some stuff together. But yeah, she's doing this big speech where she's going to take one issue that has been, you know, quite a running theme for her, which is the idea of, can we do more about tech giants, in particular in the fight against terrorism? And when she went to Italy for the G7 meeting and then again to Hamburg for the G20, this was an issue that she wanted to put right at the centre of what Britain was pushing for. This argument that actually, are companies like Facebook and Twitter and so on doing enough to both take down extremist content but also stop it at the source? Now, the big question is, does this all turn into a talking shop, or can there actually be some action? I know that Amber Rudd has already started with some sessions involving those companies, but I think Theresa May has really made this a big issue for herself over the past year. So the question will be, is there any action to actually reduce it? I mean, we could point to, for example, Facebook saying that it has started to reduce the amount of content that it finds online at a much greater rate. And I think they said they reduced 80% of it recently, so she will see that as a victory. And also, I love the fact that Prime Minister is out there talking about robots and artificial intelligence, which of course brought a smile to the face of The Guardian's very own sketchwriter, John Crace, who invented the Maybot herself.
What an absolute gift, I know, absolutely. Anoushka, thanks very much. Well, if Boris is on manoeuvres, he's by no means the only one. Influential backbencher Nick Boles said in a recent tweet, "There is a timidity and lack of ambition about Mrs May's government, which means it constantly disappoints. Time to raise your game, Prime Minister." Meanwhile, the party is still grappling to learn lessons from last year's disastrous general election and figure out how to begin reconnecting with lost voters. Now, it may be that there aren't many among Politics Weekly listeners, but one of the most interesting thinkers in the parliamentary party is George Freeman, Conservative Policy Forum chair, who last year resigned from his job in Number 10 as chair of Theresa May's policy board.
So we're here to talk about what your party needs to do to sort of bridge the gap from last year and what everyone admits was a rather sort of rocky campaign and not the result you hoped for, and the next general election, whenever that might come. It's quite a lot to do, isn't there?
Yes, I've written and spoken about, I think we're living through very turbulent political times. And there's a big question mark, I think, as to whether the two main parties can really adapt. I think we will, but it's disorientating at the moment. And on either side, to the left and the right, there are some very radical populist troublemakers who will fill the vacuum. So I think this is a big test of mainstream politics. The Labour Party's reorientating, and we have to too. For me, the big lessons of that election were the grievances that the public are clearly insisting that we tackle. And I would summarise them as one, the millennial, the under 40 generation who are feeling pretty left out of the sort of capitalist dream. Can't buy a house, struggling with debt in an insecure job market. We're not speaking to them enough. Two, people involved in working in and relying on the public services are worried that after 7 years of inevitable post-crash spending constraint, is that all we've got to offer? We need to have a more positive vision of the public services. And three, Brexit. I think the country is increasingly reconciled that we're going to leave the European Political Union, but we've got to make it a moment of inspiring national renewal so that those who didn't vote for it, like me, can be excited by it. And many of my constituents, many of the young, many of the people I've worked with in my life are really worried if this is seen as a sort of final victory of a sort of UKIP, Alf Garnett wing of conservatism. They will not be inspired to help make a success of it. United, we can make this a moment that energises this country, but divided, we'll fail whatever we try and do. For me, those are the big challenges.
And do you get a sense that the government and you know, cabinet as it is at the moment grasps the sense that it needs to do something quite radical? I mean, it sounds as though you're talking about something, you know, quite different there and a quite different approach.
I think the danger on the Conservative Party is a sort of what I would call a sort of complacent unity around, well, we'll just deliver Brexit and everything will be fine. My argument is, of course, we've got to see that Brexit referendum through, but in the spirit of one nation, not just delivering for the 52, but for everyone. And crucially, when that Brexit is complete, I hope we have a full and comprehensive trade deal with the European Union. But whatever, I think the public are going to say, well, what now? And it's crucial, I think, that for the country, as well as for the Conservative Party, there's a clear vision of how we will inspire people to make the moment that we leave the European Political Union a moment to re-energise and catalyse British politics and British policy. The challenge is, how can a Prime Minister and a Cabinet and a government largely preoccupied with negotiating Brexit find the space, the intellectual, cultural space to do that? And that's why I've called for a Beveridge Commission style, appointed by the PM. I think a profound period of party renewal. She could get a group of conservative thinkers like me and others to work with others across the board and frame a beyond Brexit agenda. I think this is a big moment. It's like 1860 with Disraeli, 1906 Churchill and the Liberals, 1946 Attlee and Churchill. We're laying the foundations of a new post-crash economic order. Difficult to do that in the sort of bunker of government managing the 24-hour media headlines.
The focus of the recent reshuffle that we saw was quite a lot of focus on appointments at CCHQ, wasn't there? Quite a lot of focus on how the party was going to be organised and run better and how campaign machinery would work better. wasn't a great deal of change of the big figures at the top that might suggest that any kind of fundamental rethink was going on. Was there? Are you confident that the kind of thinking that you're advocating is going on?
Well, you're right. The day-to-day managerial and sort of technocratic challenge of delivering Brexit, negotiating across departments, I mean, that is pretty all-absorbing. Essentially, the mood of the reshuffle was, let's repair the damage of that election campaign, learn the lessons, get better at social media, get better at... You do the basics better, all of which is important. But my argument is, not instead of that, but in addition to that, we've got 18 months where we could really do some big thinking and set out, look 10, 20 years ahead. What does the economy of tomorrow look like? What does the society of tomorrow look like? What is politics in 20 years going to look like? What do we need to be as a movement to be relevant to the 21st century and to shape it around those values that we hold dear? And I think there are thinkers in our party. There are a number of us who are up for the challenge. Nick Bowles is doing great work. Neil O'Brien's doing good work. Jesse Norman is a conservative philosopher. There's a whole load of us who are up for this. And I've never known a Conservative Party more bursting on the back benches with ideas and energy and talent. I was here in the 90s. I've seen a burnt out Conservative Party in government. That's not what I see. I see Brexit like the cork in the bottle, and the energy has got nowhere to go. And I think a commission or some way of looking ahead and showing the public that we've got more to offer than just the mechanics of Article 50, I think would be good for the national mood, good for faith in politics, and essential if we're going to hold the line.
George Freeman, thank you very much.
Now, we focused a lot in recent weeks on the reconfiguration of the Labour Party in this podcast, but at the start of a new year, I wanted to see where we thought the Tory party was headed, where its new ideas were coming from, and who we should be watching. And I'm joined now in the studio by Guardian columnist Matthew D'Ancona, Laura Perrins, editor of the website Conservative Woman, and Mark Wallace of Conservative Home. Mark, there's a sense the left has got its mojo back under Corbyn, and there's some thirst for new ideas on the centre-right of British politics, isn't there?
Indeed, there's certainly been a feeling that while the Labour Party, for good or ill, is kind of moulding its own destiny at the moment, the Conservative Party, on the other hand, is being moulded by outside forces, the actions of others and its own errors. And so I think there is quite a big challenge there, really, to say, actually, how do you get back on the front foot? How do you choose to design your own future, particularly when you've got all the challenges of government and minority government at that resting on your shoulders already?
Mm-hmm. And Brexit, Laura, that's part of the problem, isn't it? It feels as though a lot of the energy and time is being sucked into dealing with negotiations with Brussels and not so much time to think about big ideas.
Well, rightly so, though. It's a massive job to extricate ourselves now from this huge union, and it's very, very important to get it right. So you would expect most of Theresa May's time to be taken up with that. It doesn't stop people behind the scenes thinking about the big issues in terms of the NHS and the economy as a whole, though.
Matthew, is that right? Is there a sense that there's thinking going on? We were asking George Freeman this. It's not just about getting Brexit right, is it? Is it about an offer beyond that?
Yes, it is. And although I agree with Laura that there is a bandwidth issue. I mean, there's only so much time in every day. I think that the starting point with every situation like this is, what questions are you answering? And I think that the Corbyn success in the June election had a lot to do with the fact that Labour appeared to be responding to the right questions. And what the Tories need to do is get onto the right terrain, which is to look at the questions that people are actually asking, which is about the generational fairness, longevity, the digital revolution, automation, population mobility, all of these big forces. And I don't think that they are conspicuously. There were some good ideas in the manifesto, but they got somehow kind of eclipsed by the whole strong and stable mantra. And I think that it's really important that whatever thinking there is going on within the precincts of the Tory party and in the kind of think tank and digital world outside it is really ruthlessly aimed at looking at what people are asking themselves, rather than the traditions of the 1980s or the battles of the 90s or the divide within the Tory party over Europe, and concentrating ruthlessly upon electoral concerns. And I don't think they're anywhere near that yet.
And it is quite hard, Mark, isn't it? Because there's the battle going on in Parliament. You've got different wings of the party with different visions of how Brexit should be run. And, you know, so there are sort of running battles going on that issue. And it is quite hard to step back, isn't it? And think about, you know, what people are talking about on the doorsteps.
Of course. And I think there are two things going on here, really. The first is on Brexit. Yes, Laura's absolutely right. They've got to get Brexit done. They've got to get it right. And it's something that without which they'd be in really, really serious trouble. But I think one error that was made at the election was that they thought Brexit was just about the word Brexit. They didn't think back to the referendum campaign. They actually, what worked for which side in the referendum campaign? Actually, that's one reason why they ended up fighting a general election where they hired a load of people from the Remain campaign and reran Project Fear, and unsurprisingly, it didn't work. But they also neglected to look at the things, that question of taking back control, the idea of not just, oh, we're leaving the European Union, but actually what we can do after it, what we're going to do with these new powers, how are we going to change your life in that way? I think the second thing is about the Conservative Party's own culture, in that a minister a few weeks ago said something very chilling, I think, to the Sunday Times, which was, maybe we need a period in opposition to reinvent ourselves. Oh. That is absolute poison. But it does point to the challenge of how do you come up with the kind of opposition mentality, getting the fizz of ideas and the bang of kind of electoral impact, while you're also having to deal with being in government. And there's a cultural kind of challenge to deal with there.
It's quite hard, isn't it, Laura? And there does need to be some sort of positive offer and also some sort of response when Jeremy Corbyn's standing up and saying the health service is in a terrible state and people are in corridors and all those kind of things. There needs to be some sort of positive answer to that.
Well, you do have to present a positive vision. And certainly once Brexit is done, the Conservative Party have to offer a vision of what the nation will look like afterwards. And obviously different people want different things. Now, the party itself is probably in long term in real trouble. I mean, Mark must know the numbers are right down. They're really struggling with...
In terms of membership.
Mm. They're really struggling with the youth population. Now, on the other hand, the party is also... It's incredibly good at staying alive. It's stayed alive for decades, for centuries. It doesn't go down without a fight. It's very good at keeping power. But whether or not that will be good for the country as a whole, because what a lot of this comes down to at the end of the day is, where is the money going to come from? I mean, defence has been stripped to the bone. The NHS is not sustainable in its current form, but the party is too petrified to say that because everybody loves the NHS so much. So on one hand, they love the socialised medical system. This is the best system in the world. On the other hand, they're saying we can't possibly nationalise, say, water or the postal system. Well, why not? If nationalised health service can give us the best health system in the world, then why can't our nationalised rail system give us the best rail system in the world? They're completely inconsistent. The party has no coherent philosophy to me. Now, on the one hand, I wouldn't say just bow down to the market completely. Civil society and family is really, really important. That's what we've tried to talk about in the website a lot. But once you grow the state to the extent it is now, you're constantly chipping away at civil society, constantly chipping away at the family, and eventually then the money runs out.
So you'd like to see the party take a kind of clearer line and a more radical approach, but perhaps shift a little bit right, is that fair?
Well, I mean, take the NHS, which is a huge issue to everybody. You know, I've had three babies on the NHS. We all love the NHS. We all have a personal affinity to it. It is not sustainable in its current form. And we know that from their opposition to, say, nationalising the rail system. Why can't we nationalise rail if we have national health? I mean, it's one or the other. I mean, no other system in the world has it. Of course, you want to protect those who will not be able to afford basic medical health. But Switzerland managed to do this. France managed to do it. Ireland have a public-private system. But the Tories won't even consider it. Instead, week in, week out, Theresa May's up there at Question Time going, we've got the best system in the world, when all the doctors and the nurses behind them are saying, we've got patients on trolleys. So she just ends up looking like an idiot. And that's what she's left with, because no one's willing to have the conversation.
Matthew, that's an answer, isn't it? That would be a clear response to Jeremy Corbyn's sort of claims that the health service is in a mess?
It would be. I'm not sure that it would be an electoral formula for electoral success. And I think that quite often it's a mistake to think that the electorate will bow down to the power of rationality. The role of the NHS in this country is very similar to the role of the monarchy. It's an institution for which people have a very strong and emotional attachment. And it's absolutely true, Laura's right, that you could move to a system of co-payment or social insurance. But I think that any party that tried to do so, certainly in the foreseeable future, would end up in real problems. I do think on the question of the NHS narrowly, there is a real case to be made for some sort of hypothecated wealth tax. At the very minimum, I'd like to see the Tory party engaged in a cross-party health and social care review, which looked at these things on a kind of national basis, because it clearly is unsustainable on the current model. I don't think the electorate is ready to accept a kind of mixed model, except it, perhaps for a measure of co-payment for, I don't know, rooms.
That's,
and that,
that's, that why, that's because they won't talk about it at all. I mean, I agree it probably is an electoral winner, and that's what it always comes down to, right? What's good in the long run? What's good for the country? And what will get you into power? Well, I mean, she does actually have time now between the next election. I know everybody thinks Corbyn's knocking on the door. I mean, perhaps he isn't. It is time now to start saying we need to review the NHS as a whole. As the population grows, you know, ages, it's going to pull the whole country under. And we're already rationing healthcare. You know, if you either ration by, in a market, you either ration by price or you ration by bureaucracy. And at the moment, if you're cancelling all non-urgent operations in January, that's a bureaucratic rationing of healthcare. We don't have, you know, free healthcare at the point of use. You have it in February, maybe, but not January. And you can't have headlines every Christmas saying, don't go near the A&E because there's a flu. It's not sustainable.
I think some of this debate points to part of the problem they've got, which is that on one hand, there's a question of, well, we need to have much wider discussions. We need to have a campaigning going on to change the public's mind on quite fundamental things. You need to be able to talk about very, very controversial ideas as well. As
and that can take time,
well.
Right?
But at the same time, the answer is always, well, you know, the government's got to get its legislation through. It doesn't have a majority. It's got to get Brexit done. Another party or a Conservative Party at a different time wouldn't have to do all of this just itself centrally. It would have a wider movement around it. It would have a wider collection of campaigning organisations, of academics, of think tanks, of people in the culture and the arts. And you know, part of that points to what happens when you go into government is you might have a kind of grain store of ideas and people and talent. You go into government and you burn through them as the years go by. And then sometimes you go into opposition, the same before, to restock that. But
you sound like you're arguing for a period of opposition.
No, I'm very much arguing against that, in that the country definitely can't afford that, particularly now with Brexit halfway through and Corbyn knocking on the door of all people. So the Conservative Party has to find this opposition mentality somewhere while staying in government at the same time. And that means that I think it probably has to become less suspicious of some of its own kind of allies. It's quite suspicious of the idea of some of its donors, for example, giving money to people who aren't directly controlled by the central party. It's quite suspicious of the idea of, what do you mean? There could be a selection of different campaign groups with young people who believe different things and sometimes disagree with the party. It needs to relax about that. Otherwise, it's going to find itself completely alone.
I think one of the ironies of all this is that the Tory party is in some respects the victim of its own success, and that in the 80s and the early 90s, it contracted ideology and the notion that there is a direction to history, which there absolutely isn't. In its bones, it still has this feeling that the answer to all of it is to make the state much smaller and minimise taxation, which is obviously a good thing in and of itself to minimise taxation, but you have to respect the reality of the society in which you operate, which is that there is a very odd mixture in this country of individualism and liberalism on the one hand, and solidarity. There are aspects of the British psyche that do want a government that provides, and a Tory party that doesn't take account of that is just a political club.
And to what extent, Mark, does it mean building up on, I mean, you talked about those movements. There's a lot of chat about what if there was a Tory momentum, what if there was some sort of, you know, it seems to have helped Jeremy Corbyn. To what extent is it about the mechanics, or is it, you know, are there things that can be set up? Are there ways that you can start to build these sorts of movements and ideas?
I don't think you can separate the kind of mechanics and the outcome of this. The fact is, if you had more people who were more free to think about things, to debate ideas, to get involved in politics, you would end up having probably more ideas, arguably better ideas. And if you get more and better ideas and people get more of a voice, you end up with more people.
Including
as well.
At the grassroots, because the Tory party hasn't always been very keen on listening to local parties,
and
it?
Arguably, it still isn't. And but this question of let's have a Tory momentum is a ridiculous one, because ironically, what's happened is that while the Conservative Party tries to run its own affairs using the ideology of Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, kind of central command and control, the Corbynites are prospering using a free market competition model within their own movement, and that applies to everything from technical innovation of the kind of campaigning apps through to the fact that you can do crazy things at Labour conference, like go there, stand up, make a speech about an idea, and maybe even get a vote on a policy. This is completely alien to the Conservative Party the last 20 years, and I think they need to realise that if the other side, hypocritically, or albeit hypocritically, is using your own principles to outperform you, perhaps you need to look at your own principles and think, if we believe these, maybe apply them to our own operation.
Is that right, Laura? Are there more voices that we need to hear? Is that part of the answer to this?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to say. I think Mark would know more about the party, certainly the party itself. I mean, of course, what you always have to remember in a discussion like this is we are the tiny minority of people who pore over political stories day in, day out. Most people just want to get up and go to work and come home and see the kids. So they'd like to outsource all the politicking to somebody else. You know, you do have to win at least every 4 to 5 years. You do have to win their hearts and minds. You do have to say, actually, can you just listen to us now for 3 months? This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to help you. But on the other hand, I think you're right in that solidarity is a very big value in British society. I mean, conservatism is inherently the harder sell, because you're saying actually the state shouldn't help you too much, because we essentially don't think it can help you too much, and when you boil it all down, it'll do more harm to you and your family than good, and actually we're not going to tax all the rich people and give you all the money, because we'll need the same amount the next month, and we're going to have to try and, you know, liberate the market and you make responsible decisions yourself. That is always a more difficult sell than here's all the free stuff, you'll be fine for 10 years, let's not worry about what happens the 10 years afterwards. But that's what you have to do, that's what you try and have to do day in, day out, that they are the responsible government. I mean, conservatism isn't that hard. You keep what's good, you reform what's bad, you don't burn the whole place down. That's it. It's not necessarily that inspirational, but it's a pretty good message if you can actually get the messaging right.
But if you read, you know, how do you read the result of the Brexit referendum? Because that seemed to suggest, didn't it, that it was a certain amount of disquiet or...
Well, we know the southern England, it was take back control, the democratic deficit, and North England, in particular Labour heartlands, was this immigration revolution has been put on top of our heads without our consent, and we're really annoyed. This is the only time we can tell you we're really annoyed. And people like to ignore that, but that, I mean, that is the case.
Can we be confident that Conservatives have something to say to those people, to both those groups of people?
Well, they should be, because, again, the Conservatives should stand for the nation state. They should stand for the borders. You know, a nation state isn't inherently racist. We control the immigration. We decide who comes in, not the bureaucrats in Brussels. I mean, everything that went on in Europe up until about Maastricht was OK, and then Maastricht made everybody into a European citizen. You could move within the Union without a job, without a house, for at least 6 months. This is a fundamental change. This is essentially saying borders are not important. People in the north of England still actually believe in Britain, quite like their borders, quite like the nation state. I would at least like to be asked before you increase the population by, I should have written down, you know, 5 million over 5 years, and previously it took 25 years to do that. Could you ask us first?
But is it quite difficult, Matthew, to some of the analyses of the general election result suggested the reason the Tories had suffered was because they shifted too far towards bring back borders, red, white and blue, Brexit, and perhaps abandoned some of the sort of more centrist, socially liberal strands of Cameroonian conservatism?
My concern really is that we're shifting in electoral practice to a model where voters simply use elections and referenda to kick the incumbent and to demand change, either from the incumbent or from another party. I'm concerned because I think there's very little real politics in this. There's a lot of populism, which says, for instance, as in the referendum result, we're going to bring down immigration. Well, are we actually? Because the demands of the economy are such, the NHS alone employs 130,000 EU nationals, that in fact there will be so many sectoral exemptions that the numbers that lead to net immigration will probably be not that different to what they were before. I'm just concerned by the notion that a kind of a populist Toryism is the answer to this. I think, unfortunately, it is the long haul of intellectual reconstruction. Now, whether that can be done in office or in opposition, I don't know. What I do know is that Labour, during its long, 97 to 2010, found it enormously difficult to renew in office. And I don't see the engines of change really humming away on the Tory side at the moment.
Let's just do a quick round then of whether Theresa May is the right person to try and bring about that intellectual renewal. There was a feeling, wasn't there, that lots of tough compromises needed to be made to deal with the Brexit negotiations, that perhaps she stays in place, MPs thought, makes all those compromises, and then a lovely fresh face takes over before the next general election. I'm not sure that's quite the mood now, is it, Mark?
On the ideas front, the question is whether she even can if she wanted to. And to be honest with you, I think everybody else is going to have to get on with doing this renewal themselves, regardless of whether the Conservative Party, never mind itself, never mind Downing Street, is up to the task or has the time and capacity. Everybody else is starting to find ways. You can see new think tanks emerging, George Freeman's Big Tent Ideas Fest, people kind of championing it a bit, in our experience, upon the party's grassroots members and activists to actually get on with coming up with ideas for themselves. With regard to Theresa May's leadership, there's always the pendulum swings back and forth, kind of weekly or more regularly
most
than
daily,
that.
Yeah.
But realistically, I think the facts continue to suggest that we should carry on with our current leadership. We're in the middle of a Brexit negotiation. You don't want to have another leadership election. It would have to be an election this time. It couldn't be another coronation, given the outcome from last time. I don't see how that can happen during the talks. The danger is, if Downing Street gives any further hints that it's getting occupied with the frankly mad idea that perhaps she could lead us into the next general election and live on, that'll be the moment of paramount danger for her premiership.
Laura, is she safe for now, do you think?
She's probably safe for now. As I said, the survivability of the Conservative Party, they'll stuff a mounter and stick her in number 10 till the next election if necessary. It's what they do.
Matthew, what do you think?
Well, that's the problem. It's a taxidermist's government, isn't it? I mean, simply being in number 10 is not the same as governing. I mean, look, my position is straightforward. I think she gambled and lost in the election. She should have gone on the morning of June the 9th. And the longer she stays in office, the easier Jeremy Corbyn's job at the election becomes, because what everyone thinks about the Tories is that they feel they're entitled to office, and this reinforces that disastrously.
Now, if recent developments in Washington have made America a less reliable partner for Europe in the short term at least, many on the continent are looking for potential opportunities and partnerships in Asia. And with the centre of economic gravity shifting ever closer to China, will a distinction between Europe and Asia begin to erode? I'm joined by Bruno Massaich, author of a new book, The Dawn of Eurasia. So, Bruno, Europe has spent the past decade or so dealing with a series of crises, hasn't it? Whether it's the financial crisis, whether it's its relationship with Russia, whether it's Brexit here in the UK, migration. Has it not thought enough about what lies to the east?
I think that has been the problem. We were very closed within ourselves, not looking to the rest of the world, not looking east. And if you look at the crises that we've been going through, they are crises of coming from the east, a crisis about the management of our borders with the Asian, the steppes, the region of disorder. So if you look at refugees, if you look at Ukraine, if you look at our tensions with Russia, if you look at our difficulty in understanding China, that has to do with this fact that we have a very parochial, peculiar, safe, ordered way of life, and we have trouble understanding what lies to this mythical East.
We think a lot about the US, don't we, in our relationship with the US, and we think a lot about our relationship with China, but you argue that we need to completely rethink those relationships, and in particular, we need to rethink the relationships with China and Russia.
Yes, I think so. We have still this mindset that we are special, that the whole world is going to become like Europe.
To catch up is the idea we often have, don't we?
That's right. And in a way, they have caught up, but the problem is that they have caught up on technology, on economic development, but they haven't exactly caught up on the European way of life. The point I make in the book is that, in fact, they are going in a very different direction. We are entering a very dangerous moment when we have different blocks in the world, different almost civilizations that are equally modern, equally technological, but they have fundamental differences between themselves. And so we're setting up the stage for a clash, a very intense competition between different ways of life.
So tell us how the European Union, which has tended to think that it's got this sort of rules-based order, it has this approach which perhaps eventually everyone will end up adopting. We can do lots of trade deals around the world and they'll all end up being a little bit like us. How does Europe manage its way through this very important moment that you're talking about? You suggest we need to think a bit more about geopolitics.
Almost the opposite of what we're doing. You see that we talk only about the future of Europe. And the point my book makes is that the really important question is the future of Eurasia. What shape will the combination of the two continents take? President Macron of France the other day said that he wants every young European to learn two other European languages. And I was listening to this and thinking, how is this possible? This was a goal for our grandparents, not a goal now. We have to learn two non-European languages. By the way, I think European mastery and knowledge of non-European languages has been decaying, not improving. And so I think we need to realize that our neighbors are India, Russia, China. Our politics has to become a lot about this question of how we relate to them. We have to realize that half of these new relationships will be about cooperation, but the other half is going to be about conflict and competition. So we also have to become a bit tougher along that dimension and realize that they are not becoming like us, and so there is room for competition. So I think a lot to change, almost the opposite of what the European Union is doing right now.
Mm. And we need to think a little bit more, do we, about projecting power, about... I mean, you think of the great game where there was sort of different power blocks contending, you know, great swathes of territory. You're not talking about war here, are you? But you are talking about sort of power and you know, competition for influence.
Yes, I think this competition will, in this century, will be mostly about infrastructure, trade, information, cyber, technology, who is going to control the next wave of technological development, artificial intelligence in particular. So I'm not predicting war, but I am predicting a world of very intense competition. And this, by the way, is the mindset that I see in Russia and China. It's not the mindset that I see in Brussels.
Mm. Just one thing I want to ask, you've written a piece in The Guardian about this today, I know, but, you know, here on this chilly little island, we're quite obsessed now with our relationship with the European Union and with leaving the European Union. Is that the right way to play things if we're looking at a world in which you have these great power blocks contending with each other? Shouldn't we attach ourselves to the nearest power block? How should we play it?
There's two ways to do it. One, yes, you could conclude that European countries are too small to be on their own in this grand chessboard. But there's also the possibility, once you have chosen Brexit, and I wouldn't myself if it was up to me, but once you have chosen Brexit, there's also the possibility of becoming a very flexible, small country, which can look both to the east and both to the west, can take advantage of the immigrant communities in the UK, can perhaps deviate from European norms and rules when that suits you. But that takes a certain spirit that I don't always see in the UK. There's also lots of people that voted leave that want the UK to close its borders, to go back to a very strong sense of British or even English identity. And I think that would be a recipe for disaster in this world that I describe in the book.
Mm. So we need to be internationalists, but looking in a different direction.
Yes, a Eurasian Britain that can establish connections to Indonesia, to India, to China, that can play the role of a bridge between the Asian superpowers and the European Union on occasion. Most of the time, I think it will be siding with the European Union, but it has a certain flexibility that it can use. And that would be, I think, the best way to take advantage of Brexit now that you have it on your hands.
Bruno Massage, thank you very much. Well, you can find Bruno's book, The Dawn of Eurasia, at the Guardian Bookshop online. It's published by Penguin and is out now. But for now, my thanks to Bruno Massage, Matthew D'Ancona, Mark Wallace, Laura Perrins and Anushka Astana. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.